You're very welcome to Tuesday Night's Arena. I'm Rick O'Shea. As we wrap up 2025, it's the perfect time to reflect on some of the cultural highlights that have lit up our year. And to help us delve into the best of film and music and TV and books, I'm joined in studio by Paul Whittington, Sinead Gleeson, Chris Wasser and Zara Hedeman. You're all very welcome, Paul. We have a lot to get to, so we're going to kick off with you first. Where do you want to start?
With two films, Rick, that America talking to itself, basically two big, big films. The Brutalist first and One Battle After Another. And I think probably a lot more people are going to get to see One Battle After Another than The Brutalist. Paul Thomas Anderson, he's never been given an Oscar, which some people are upset about, and he may well get one for this because it's a very interesting film. It's based on a novel by Thomas Pynchon called Vineland, but cleverly, which was based in the 60s and then the 80s, but he shifted it forward to mainly the present day, and it begins in 2008 with this terror cell, who are high-minded, left-wing terror cell, called the French 75. They are bombing banks and trying to free immigrants, and then one of them gets caught, Perfidia Beverly Hills, the character's name played by Teyana Taylor, and her partner, Bob Ferguson, Leo DiCaprio, goes on the run with their daughter. And then we go forward a decade and a half to the present, more or less. He's in hiding, and he is found by an enemy played by Sean Penn in an extremely strange performance.
And you want to pair that with something else.
Yeah, The Brutalist appeared really much earlier in the film, and in fact Adrian Brody will probably get an Oscar nomination for it. And it's a Brady Corbett film, another big film, 3.5 hours. Great to see in the cinema in 70 mil. They had a break, you know, intermission. You could go out and, you know, have your cocktail and come back, and you needed it because this is a big film again. It's set in the 1940s, and Adrian Brody is Laszlo Toth, this Hungarian immigrant and camp survivor who comes to America. He's a Bauhaus trained architect, and he wants to get ahead, but he finds that America, post-war America, to be a kind of increasingly brutal and anti-Semitic place. And he becomes involved with this billionaire, played by Guy Pearce, who's really good in it, who commissions him to build this huge church on his land, and this huge brutalist building becomes a metaphor for all sorts of things. I think neither film is perfect. It's the more successful. But One Battle After Another at times is brilliant. There is a chase sequence that is referring to Bullet, but is just extraordinary. So two very interesting films.
I want to take a clip from The Brutalist. This is Guy Pearce's Van Buren, and he's seeking out Adrian Brody's Laszlo Toth to show him some of his drawings of buildings he created before the war.
These are yours, yes?
Yes.
All of them?
Yes.
I'm sorry, have I upset you?
No. No, don't. Did not realize these images were still available, much less of any consequence. May I keep these?
Of course you may. Very artistic.
That's from The Brutalist. Paul, just briefly, do you think it's going to be Paul Thomas Anderson's year?
I think it probably will be, director-wise. I think they have to. They'd be too ashamed not to at this stage.
We're going to move on to books. Sinead Gleeson, welcome to the programme. We could spend the whole hour talking about books of 2025, but where do you want to start?
I'm going to sort of take a leaf out of Paul's book and put two things together, which is both by the same writer, which is the American writer Maggie Nelson, who is a kind of, was a poet for years and then started publishing sort of critical writing, essays, nonfiction. And this book is called Pathemata, or The Story of My Mouth. And pathemata is a Greek word for suffering through learning. And it's basically a very short book about this unexplained pain she's had in her face since she was a teenager. She's gone to gurus, she's gone to orthodontists, she's gone to chronic pain people. And this sounds like, do I want to read a book about pain? But of course, like all her great work and all great essays, it's not about a singular subject. It's written during the pandemic. It's about kind of cohabiting and bubbles and loneliness. It's about parenthood. It's about silence and speaking. It's about our voices. It's about care and bodies and all sorts of other things. It's kind of a book about talking about suffering and connection. And in talking about her own, it sort of makes you examine your own suffering and your own own sort of what we all went through and how you sort of, you've dealt with chronic pain at all. It's a really interesting read. Another book that she published, it's kind of a book, a sort of an essay length book, is published at the end of the year, is called The Slicks, where she unites two poetic giants, which are Sylvia Plath and Taylor Swift. And it's a really interesting book. And also with a little nod to Kamala Harris, because it's about the idea of power and fame, particularly in relation to women. The idea that women shouldn't, are discouraged from saying, I really want this. I mean, she reckons Kamala Harris never said, I really want this, and that she was just kind of shoved into it by Biden. It's really interesting on sort of power dichotomy, women, fame, and yeah, who would put Sylvia Plath and Taylor Swift together? Nobody but Maggie Nelson can get away with doing that. So I'd recommend both of those books by her.
I like that 2025 has some short recommendations for you. It's been the year of short recommendations for
all
me
my
as
books
well,
tonight so. Are very short. Fantastic. I have to tell you, one okay. sitting reads.
Chris Wasser, TV. You and I have talked about TV a lot this year, but where are you going to start? What's your opener for me?
I think we'll start with the most talked about television show of the year, which was Adolescence, from Stephen Graham, who created, co-wrote and also stars in this, and Jack Thorne. Developed by Graham initially from this idea to basically develop a truthful artistic response to what Graham calls an epidemic of knife crime amongst young lads up and down the UK. So the story and the characters here are completely fictional, but the series is firmly based, you know, in a horrible reality, unfortunately. So it follows a 13-year-old schoolboy, Jamie Miller, played by Owen Cooper, a complete newcomer, plucked from obscurity from this. Fantastic. He wakes up one morning at 6 a.m. To find the police in his bedroom and the house completely ransacked. It turns out that Jamie is going to be charged with the murder of a female classmate. His dad, Eddie, Stephen Graham, who becomes his appropriate responsible adult in the police station, says, no, you've got the wrong house. This can't be my boy. They haven't got the wrong house. And you very quickly discover with this show that it's not about whether or not Jamie did it. We know that he did it. The evidence is all there. There's horrible CCTV footage. It becomes about the impact that this horrible crime has had, not just on Eddie's family, but obviously his victim's family. So you have this series split into four episodes. One episode is about the arrest and the charging. The second, the investigation by Ashley Walters, detective. The third, then 7 months later, where the young lad is interviewed by a child psychologist, brilliantly portrayed by Aaron Doherty. And then the fourth, the impact, the aftermath a year later on this family when Jamie is, you know, behind bars at this point. A lot of people talked about the fact that a lot of focus was on how this series was made, because Philip Barantini, a filmmaker before this, best known for Boiling Point, which was a terrific one-shot restaurant drama, very stressful, with Stephen Graham again. They're just, you know, kind of creative soulmates at this point. This series, every episode was done in one take, and I realize that these things are easier to do nowadays, you know, with careful, you know, planning and storyboarding and rehearsing, but the technical wizardry here, I've seen some of the behind the scenes footage and I still can't figure out how they made the series. I don't think I want to. I think that's part of the magic. But all of that, again, Rick, would just be a gimmick if the storytelling wasn't up to scratch, if the performances weren't up to scratch, and if the ideas weren't, unfortunately, relevant. It's a brilliant series with something to say, beautifully performed by Stephen Graham, and I think it's changed Owen Cooper's life as well. He's come out of nowhere, and now he's, you know, he's going to be starring in the next Wuthering Heights film. So, wonderful young actor.
Okay, this is from Adolescence. It's Aaron Doherty as Bryony Ariston, the psychologist assigned to 13-year-old Jamie, played by Owen Cooper. And she's asking him about photos he has in his phone of some of his classmates.
You saw photos of two girls in your year topless?
Yeah.
Would they be happy you saw those photos?
Everyone else did.
Was Katie one of those two girls?
What? How do you know that?
How did it feel to see that?
No. How'd you guess that?
I didn't guess it. I asked it, and now I'd like to know what it felt like to see her like that.
What? You're asking whether I got a hard on?
I'm asking how it felt.
I liked it. I'd be allowed to talk like this.
How does it make you feel looking at naked pictures of people?
How do you think?
In particular, how does it make you feel looking at naked pictures of people you know?
I don't know. Good.
Powerful? Do you feel like it gives you a power?
No. It's just weird.
Were you attracted to Katie?
She wasn't my type.
So you weren't?
She was quite, no offence, quite flat, you know.
And that's from Adolescence, which is still streaming on Netflix. Zara Hederman, Geese, Geese, Geese. Is that where we're starting at the beginning of the year? The band that everybody's talking about.
Yeah, if 2024 was Brat Summer, 2025 was Cameron Winter. So Cameron Winter, frontman of Geese, they released their fourth album, Getting Killed, which was an album that Cillian Murphy became obsessed with and Nick Cave said was a source of genuine joy that washes away anxiety. And I couldn't agree more. Like, when this album came out in September, it's one that since then I have never been able to stop listening to it. Like, I have it on repeat constantly. It's just an amazing, like, mix of, like, Velvet Underground, Radiohead style, and even with the Radiohead kind of nod, Nigel Godrich had them in a Live from the Basement session, which is just incredible. You should seek it out on YouTube. And basically, Cameron Winter last year as well released a solo album called Heavy Metal, which throughout the year as well as touring, getting killed with his band Geese, he's also been doing these really incredible solo piano tours. Recently, he was in Carnegie Hall and he was the youngest person since Bob Dylan in 1963 to sell it out. He's only 23. And that was filmed by Paul Thomas Anderson. So a nice tie-in with Paul's pick earlier. And what I just love about this is his lyrics and his presence throughout the album. So we start off with a song called like Trinidad, which is this really harrowing, really scary song. There's a bomb in his car. And then a few songs later, we have a song, Au Pays de Cocaine, where he's like really vulnerable and lovelorn. And he's saying to someone, you can stay with me and just pretend I'm not there. So such a great dichotomy in his lyrics, but like so experienced, so insightful, so raw and so like believable as well. And he carries it with just the most unexpected baritone style voice. This as well, like, has really got me just excited about bands. Like this, as I said, I've been listening to it constantly. My friends and I are addicted to this album, so much so that we found out that all the songs were on karaoke on YouTube, and after a birthday party we all went back to my house and we did it from
Geese
front
karaoke
to back.
2025. Okay, in case you haven't heard Geese, this is from Getting Killed and this is Au Pays de Cocaine. That's Geese, Au Pays de Cocaine, and that's the first of our music recommendations this year. I'm going to go back to movies. So, Paul, I talked to Eva Victor, the filmmaker of Sorry Baby, earlier this year on Arena, and I'm so glad this film has found an audience.
Yeah, it was certainly one of my favourite films of the year. It's her debut as a director, and Eva Victor is amazing in it, and it's such an interesting film on many levels because it kind of fights against the trauma, cliches and so forth. Eve Victor plays Agnes, she's a literature professor in this kind of liberal arts college, and her friend Lydia, who's played by Naomi Ackie, comes up to see her, and she's getting married, she's going to have a baby, and her sort of personal life has moved on. Agnes is a professor, which she always wanted to be. She's an English professor, which is great, but she's sort of stalled for some reason. Then we go back in time to find out why. And we see them both when they're at college, and she's a star student and the apple of her professor's eye, Preston Decker, this guy. But when she goes to his house one time to talk about her thesis, she is assaulted. And she goes, it's a very interesting scene after she goes home. She talks to Liddy and they basically agree, yes, it was the thing, by which they mean rape. But the way in which she responds to it is quite interesting, because she doesn't want him to go to jail. She just can't understand why somebody can simultaneously be this cultivated person and then do that. And then subsequently, she's not always thinking about it. She's obviously had a disastrous aspect in her life, trust, etc., etc. But she's still her, and she's still funny, and she's still all the other things she is. And it's a very funny, cleverly written film. So instead of being one thing, it's many things, which I think is truer than, you know, than the trauma cliche idea.
It is an absolutely wonderful film. Yeah. Let's take something from it. This is Agnes Eva Victor. She's in the supermarket with her recently acquired emotional support kitten.
Is this all for you today?
Yes, thank you.
Did you bring a cat into the grocery store?
No.
Yes, you did.
What did you say?
You're lying.
No, I'm not.
Is your cat food?
That's from Sorry Baby. I realise now it's the year of the Agneses or Agneses as well, because we're about to talk about one more Agnes a little bit later on as well. Another book, Sinead, where are you going next?
I've picked a memoir by Eoin Lee. Eoin Lee is an extraordinary writer. She's published several novels, short story collections. I included an essay of hers in This Woman's Work, where she wrote about learning English through Chinese pop songs. She was Born in China, and then also propaganda songs. But this book is quite extraordinary. And I think at this time of the year, a lot of people are sort of reflecting on life and thinking about grief and people who aren't with us anymore. So this might sound a little bit dark, but it's, I think, probably the most extraordinary book I've read about grief in a very long time. It's called Things in Nature Merely Grow. And Eun had two sons, and both of her sons took their own life. And I don't even know how she was able to write the book, because she wrote this quite quickly after the death of her second child. It's very much in the vein of like stoicism. There's no sentimentality. There's no kind of moment where you're meant to get the heartstring moment. She's just talking about it in a very factual, basic way. It doesn't sugarcoat anything. It doesn't sort of, but it offers so much hope and positivity about, you know, it's the worst imaginable thing I think that could happen to anybody. And yet she managed to pick herself up and write. And it's just that idea that art can be redemptive, that it can offer you something that when you don't know how to go on, you go on by writing or making films or making albums or whatever it is. But it's kind of a book about coping, and I just found it extraordinary and devoid of all the sentimentality that some so-called grief memoirs can have. But she's just, because she's a beautiful sentence writer, so yeah, I would totally recommend that.
I think it's great at this time of year when so many memoirs sell so well.
Yeah.
It's nice to think outside.
Yeah, it's won a lot of awards as well. It's been nominated for a lot of things, but it's just, and it's short, and because it is intense and compressed, but it's not a long book.
And that is Yi Yun Lee's Devastating Things in Nature Merely Grow. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. I am joined by my panel, where we're talking about the year's best films, books, TV and music. And we're back after this. This is Tuesday Night's Arena and our panel with the best films, books, TV and music of the year. We've already had some suggestions. Chris Wasser, I'm going to go to you next for a TV series that I've seen people talk about but has kind of completely passed me by, and that's Task.
You should definitely catch up on it over the Christmas. Task is from Brad Inglesby, who had a massive hit with Mayor of Easttown and has delivered here another moody and magnificent crime saga that's actually quite novelistic in places. We've known 1,000 crime solvers like Mark Ruffalo's Tom Brandis. You know, he's a special agent with a messy past and a tragic present. He's actually on desk duty for the FBI when we first encounter him. You know, he's basically selling, or he's handing out FBI cards to graduates who might be interested in joining the force. But in the evenings, he is, you know, he's a bit of a cliche at the beginning. He's drinking too much. He's avoiding any sort of meaningful conversation with his daughter. And it'd be a shame to spoil the initial setup of this show and, you know, to tell you too much about why Tom is in such an awful state. But we will say that, you know, in this house, something awful has happened. A son is no longer around. He's actually awaiting a sentence for a horrible, almost unforgivable crime. So Tom is, you know, pretty happy to not do anything spectacular with his workday. That might have to change though, because the other side of the story follows a couple of guys, Robbie, played by Tom Pelfrey, and Cliff, his best pal Cliff, played by Raul Castillo. Two garagemen in Philadelphia who used to be connected with a dangerous biker gang called the Dark Hearts. And they have been hitting up old drug houses and robbing drug houses that they know there's an awful lot of money in. Unfortunately, one robbery goes a bit too far. They take something that they really shouldn't have, and they also kidnap a child. So that leads to Brandis being called back into the job that he used to do before he sat at a desk, assembling a task force to try and capture these two men. One of them is an unpredictable state trooper played by Cork's Alison Oliver. And you also have one of the Dark Heart biker lads played by our own Sam Keeley. So it's only a matter of time before Brandis and Robbie come into contact with each other. And it's only a matter time before Robbie gets caught. Here's the thing though, you don't want Robbie to get caught, because in a series like this, you're used to, you know, Robbie's hard man type character being the sort of guy who maybe, you know, talks with his fists. That's not Robbie at all. He's quite soulful. He's very easy to like. He's got a big heart. He's not motivated by greed or anything like that, or hatred. He's motivated by, you know, heartache and redemption. He just wants to make his life. He's made some terrible mistakes in his life. He wants to make things better for his kids, for his niece. So you have these two men who are in such an awful state, as I say, and watching the 8 hours of this television series, I just never knew which one of them I wanted to win. And that's the beauty of it, I think.
Okay, this is from Task. It's Tom Brandis, Mark Ruffalo's character, working in his garden when he sees his daughter Emily head off to school, and Emily is played by Silvia Dionicio.
Morning.
Morning.
Did you eat them? I made some scrambled eggs and scrap.
I'm gonna be late.
Okay. Well, anything you want for dinner tonight? I could stop by the Acme.
I have work.
Right, big night. Maybe I'll drop by for a water ice.
There's a package there for you.
All right. Have a good day.
That's from Task, which is on Sky Atlantic, and it's streaming on now as well. Zara Hederman, where are we going with music?
So we're going to Maria Somerville's Luster, which is her second album. And as well as it being one of the most anticipated Irish albums of the year, it's been my anticipated album for maybe 6 years, because I absolutely adored her debut, All My Friends, which had this gorgeous intimacy, quite a bedroom recording feel to it. It was very lo-fi ambient. So I was really interested to see where she was going to take that, especially because she was signed to 4AD, which was huge news and great news for her. So with this, she returned to Connemara, where she's from, stayed in a cottage overlooking Loch Carrib and invited some friends to record. And I think a lot of the recording was done at night, which you really get a sense of, because this album, surprisingly to me, was so much fuller band. It has such a denser sound and there's more textures to it. There's more guitar and drums in it. And it really captures as well the kind of landscape, I feel, the vastness of Connemara. And within that too, like, her voice is something that I love so much, where it's really breathy and airy and very ethereal. And the contrast to the much heavier musical sensibility works so well. And there's also, I feel, a bit more of a focus on what she's saying. Like, it's a very reflective album. Like, within the 5 years, she's done a lot of kind of thinking and soul searching on it, and it doesn't impose too much. It's just a really nice quality to tune into that element sometimes when you listen. Sometimes you can listen to the more kind of bigger musical moments. But what it was great as well was she was actually chosen by My Bloody Valentine to open for her in the Three Arena.
She was incredible.
Amazing. And it was great to see, like, just the full venue so enraptured by her. And it was her and her band. I think she plays as well with, like, Henry Ernest. Olin Monk as well, I think, contributed to the album. And it's just one that I'm so excited for what's next, because with each one, she's still melding all of the things from All My Friends, but just tweaking it up ever so slightly.
And that's always lovely to see, because frequently people in large venues like that might not necessarily be as respectful to the support act as they should be. Mm. Let's take some Maria Somerville. This is a track called Garden.
Passage of time, I want to go down.
That's Maria Somerville. The album is Luster, and it's called Garden. Films, Paul Whittington, A House of Dynamite is where you're going next.
Yeah, released in cinemas for 5 minutes by Netflix before disappearing into their vaults. And I'm not sure how many people have actually seen it. It's a timely reminder from Catherine Bigelow that all these foghorn despots we're currently afflicted with have big bombs pointed at each other. It's a very clever thriller. It's told Rashomon style, which is to say from three different points of view, the same story. And Rebecca Ferguson plays this army captain who is going into work when they find out that a nuclear missile has appeared in the Pacific and is heading towards America. Initially, they think it's going to crash in the sea, but then they realise that it may actually land in Chicago. So we look at them, we look at an initial response unit that tries to shoot it down, we look at the army. Tracy Letts plays this great, he's kind of the equivalent of the character in Doctor Strangelove, but in a toned down way. He just thinks they should retaliate, but against whom? Because they don't know who fired it. So we're going to look weak if we don't retaliate is his problem with it. And then we go eventually to the president, who's played by Idris Elba, who's a very sort of laid back Barack Obama type president who's watching teenage girls play basketball when he hears the news, and off he goes. And he's the one with the big decisions to make. She's really good at this stuff. I'm sure you saw, Chris. It's a brilliantly put together thriller, and you just can't stop watching it when you start it. The acting's really good, and it scares the hell out of you. It's not very Christmassy, let's face it.
Yeah, you are left at the very end with a large hole in the pit of your stomach.
You are indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's take something from it, though. This is Olivia Walker, the great Rebecca Ferguson. She's calling her husband to warn him to take their son and get away.
Okay. Hey.
Listen to me, get Liam.
Get in the car and just start driving. Right?
Where? What are you talking about?
West. Go west as fast as you can. Get away from any urban centers you can.
Liv,
get,
what
okay?
The fuck?
Listen,
what's going on there?
I'll call you. I love you. I love you. Can you kiss Liam for me? Just kiss him. Bye.
Okay, Sinead, favourite novel of the year is where you're going next. And from you, this is going to be really interesting and high praise indeed, so go for it.
This is, a short novel called Seascraper by a writer called Benjamin Woods. And I hadn't actually heard of him, and it's a fifth novel. He's in his 40s. But it was longlisted for the Booker. It wasn't shortlisted. And it's a very short, small, atmospheric novel. So it tells the story of a young man called Tom Flett. He is a shanker, which is a shrimp fisherman. He lives on a kind of murky coast in Britain with his mother. He comes from a long line of shankers. It's very thankless, hard, dangerous work. And he's sort of a daydreamer. He wants to be a musician. He fancies a girl in the area. He wants to play her songs and get gigs in the local pub and thinks nothing's going to really happen for him. His mother's single and kind of has a lot of suitors who come to the house, and one of them is an American film director who comes to the house one day, who sort of fills his head with nonsense, going, help me scout locations, I can make you a star. And there's a kind of a wonderful sort of surreal scene where they go at night, sort of like where there are sinkholes and it's dangerous. Basically, he wants a life that he doesn't have. And I think the book is about this idea of what's a good life, what's an interesting life. Does everybody want to have fame and acclaim and fulfillment, or is it enough to kind of live in this small town with your mother and play guitar in your bedroom? So I just thought it was really beautiful. It's very atmospheric, kind of haunting, very filmic. Like, you feel like you need to scrape the brine and the sea salt off yourself at the end of it. But I think it should have won the Booker, but it was longlisted. But I absolutely loved it.
It is one of those books, and there's been, you can't call it a trend really this year, but yeah, there have been a lot of books that are set in those kind of rural settings with those kinds of characters. Yeah. And they make for really interesting, fertile ground.
There's only three or four people in the book. I mean, that's the main thing. It's very small and compressed and sort of insular, but it's really powerful and page-turnery. But I loved it. He's a beautiful kind of sentence prose writer as well. And it's just murky, dark, a bit claustrophobic. I loved it.
And that's Benjamin Woods' Seascraper is the book. Chris Wasser, let's talk about one of my favourite TV series of the year and one of the things that brought me the most joy in 2025, Leonard and Hungry Paul.
We talked about this when we reviewed it back in October, that, you know, not every small screen hit needs to be noisy and big and full of complications, but I think that some viewers get a little bit confused when something nice and simple comes along. Author, a British talent, although he is sporting a no-perfect South County Dublin accent in this thing, he is a man in his 30s, a ghostwriter of children's encyclopedias, never really considered a life outside of the one that he shares with his mom. They live together, but, you know, as he says in the opening scenes, like, there's nothing weird about that. You know, I don't plan on moving out. We're best friends, and we always are going to be. Unfortunately, you know, change is inevitable, as is familial heartache, and mom dies one day, and that leaves Leonard behind, kind of asking, you know, wrestling with the big questions: who am I now without mom, and what am I going to do with my life? He doesn't go down to the pub. He doesn't, you know, join a dating app. He just goes around to his old friend, Hungry Paul, played by Laurie Coniston, and Hungry Paul's name is never explained here. We just go with it.
Nor in the book.
And I'm okay with that. And the two of them just shoot the breeze, and they play board games, and they talk about, you know, the fact that Leonard has a crush on a girl at work, Derry Girls' Jamie Lee O'Donnell, the fact that Hungry Paul's sister is getting married, which means he's going to have to be in a social circle that he doesn't want to be. And that is pretty much it. It's about, you know, male friendship and ordinary everyday people with ordinary everyday problems. But this show got a lot of attention for its famous narrator, Julia Roberts, who is famously a fan of the novel and jumped at the opportunity. I mean, the film, or the producers, took, you know, a risk. Not really much of a risk, but they just sent out an email to the agency saying, would Julia like to narrate this? And she said yes. And you think that that might overshadow proceedings, you think it might be a little bit gimmicky, but there's something very comforting, natural and familiar about Julia Roberts' narration, that it's just the cherry on the cake, you know, it's a warm hug. And it really works for it, because Leonard is a man who doesn't say much. He's a man who, as he says, was born without a eureka face, and he's sometimes incapable of communicating what's inside of his head, but he's got Julia Roberts to do that for him. So it's very funny, very sweet, as I say, about male friendship, the quiet comfort of routine, and just the funny little things that ordinary everyday people do to keep this all ticking over, basically.
It's also one of those rare TV series from this year that you can say about it, it does not fit any kind of cookie cutter that any other TV series has been made from. And that's in a world where every week we have conversations about TV shows that feel or kind of sound or look like other things that have happened earlier this year or last year or the year before.
Yeah, even the aesthetic of this thing, the way it looks, the way it's performed, the simple, straightforward, told in chronological order structure of it, which, you know, I love. There is nothing else like this year. It was on BBC earlier this year, and it's going to be broadcast on RT in 2026.
Okay, let's take something from Leonard and Hungry Paul. Shelley, the fire drill officer, approaches Leonard at his desk to remind him that there's a fire drill happening. This is Shelley, played by Jamie Lee O'Donnell, and Leonard by Alex Lawther.
Fire! You have to get out of here. Run for your life!
Is it a fire or a fire drill?
I'm actually not allowed to answer that question. And even if I was, it doesn't really matter. You still have to get out of here. That was the rules, partner.
I'm
I'm okay. I'll take my chances.
Oh, no, 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 no. I see you've left me no alternative. I'm going to have to pull rank on you. They don't give this sash to just anybody, you know. I had to complete an in-service course that lasted nearly an hour.
Fine.
Thank you. Let's go. Thank you. You have to run this way, thanks. Yep.
That's from Leonard and Hungry Paul. It was on BBC One and it will be screening on RTE in 2026, as Chris said. Zara, where do we go next with music?
I think we go Alex G, Headlights next. So this is his 10th studio album, but first signed to a major label. So he signed with RCA. Real ones will remember him as Sandy Alex G back in the day when he was releasing onto Bandcamp. And as his career has developed, his profile has just gradually gotten bigger and he's getting more attention, whether he was working with Frank Ocean or composing music for Jane Schoenburn's I Saw the TV Glow and We're All Going to the World's Fair movies. On this one, he's kind of gone completely technicolor. So previously his albums were quite like discordant, very obscure, very lo-fi. And on this one, I was really shocked to hear how like pretty and like bright this was. He was inspired by like Neil Young, Lucinda Williams, Elliot Smith. And in a kind of like David Berman, All My Favourite Singers Couldn't Sing way, he has a very conversational tone. He's not the most accomplished singer, but I really like that. It's very endearing quality to it. He's also on this album bringing the mandolin back, which I...
The mandolin never went out of fashion.
I know. He's bringing it to the younger generations, to the masses. But I just love how he's kind of married all of his musical sensibilities together. And his popularity has grown so much that with the last two times he's come to Ireland, he's played Vicar Street twice, sold it out, and another date has had to be added. So he's really great at just continually like building up the fidelity of his music and turning it up, making it brighter.
Okay, Alex G from Headlights. This is a song called Afterlife. Afterlife from Alex G here on Tuesday Night's Arena. We have our panel with us talking about the best films, books, TV and music of the year, and we'll have more for you after these. This is Tuesday Night's Arena, our best of panel for 2025, films, books, TV and music. Paul Whittington, Sentimental Value is the next one for you.
Yes, an antidote to a lot of the mid-Atlantic dross we all watch on streaming channels. This is a lovely film, Joachim Trier. It's a Norwegian film and it's been compared to Ingmar Bergman's films a little bit. There is a little bit of a whiff of Bergman off it, but it's a very original film as well. And the ever-wonderful Renate Reinsve is Nora Borg, and she's an Oslo stage actress. And we first see her, she's suffering from crippling bout of stage fright, which actually makes you feel like you have stage fright yourself as you watch it. She's so good. She overcomes it and everybody thinks she's wonderful afterward, but she's not a happy bunny, and we soon find out why. Her mother dies. She and her sister, Agnes, who's played by Igna Ibsdotter Lilias, they were raised mainly by their mother. Their father, this histrionic film director, disappeared to everyone's relief when they were quite young. But he returns for the funeral wearing his best black suit. He is Gustav, and he's played by Stellan Skarsgård, and acts as if nothing has happened. And my lovely daughters. Agnes is more sympathetic towards him. Nora is not at all. And she just doesn't want to fall for his rubbish. And especially when he tells her he has this script, this ragged handwritten script for a screenplay. And he's written a character for her and it's about his mother. We then hear the story in bits and pieces through the film of this same house where his mother lived with him when he was small. She had been in the resistance during the war and was tortured by the Nazis and went to a camp. Her unhappiness transmitted to him. So everyone has their story. There's an excuse for his behaviour. He is tremendous in it, Skarsgård. He's really funny and sort of over the top and sort of really solipsistic but lovable at the same time, if that is possible. And the relationship between him and the two daughters, but particularly between him and Nora, is fascinating, especially as Nora starts to realise that she's actually quite like him.
Okay, this is from Sentimental Value. It is Stellan Skarsgård as Gustav, Elle Fanning playing Rachel, the American actress who is involved in his film, and as the character of Agnes, Inga Ibsdotter Lilias.
Rachel, this is my daughter Agnes.
Hi, Rachel.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Are you in the business as well?
Oh, no.
No, she helps me with research on dress.
Yeah, I'm an academic historian. Yes. Sorry, I'm... Nå får jeg ikke til å snakke ordentlig.
Do you recognize her? She played Anna in the film you saw.
Oh, yeah, that's a long time ago.
Of course. That's... You're Anna. That's right. I see it. Can I take a selfie with you? Yeah, sure. Starstruck.
And that is from Sentimental Value. Sinead, books next. You want to just package a few of them together because you want to make sure you get to everything. This is good. Go for
it. Because it was such a great year for Irish literature, and there was three novels I particularly liked. Everybody probably has read some of Wendy Erskine's short stories. She's a wonderful short story writer, and the jump to the novel doesn't always work, but in this case it does. Her novel, The Benefactors, is set in Belfast. It's about the aftermath of a sexual assault, and the three main voices, it's sort of three women who are connected to the story, but there are like multiple voices in the book. It's a word, polyphonic, is something I'd use about it. It's a very sort of aural sort of book. It's also very funny. It's really dark. It's very good on class and privilege, and I absolutely loved it. I also wanted to mention Elaine Feeney's Let Me Go Mad in My Own Way, a great title from Elektra, which is about a writer whose relationship is broken down in London, and she goes back to the west of Ireland where she's confronted with her present day family, but also the ghosts of sort of colonial history in Ireland. It's really well done, beautifully written. And a book that I didn't hear a lot about, but that I absolutely loved because I was reading a lot of stuff for various reasons. David Park, a wonderful writer from the north of Ireland, Ghost Wedding, which is ostensibly about the revamping of a fancy hotel in the present and then drifts back to a time when this house was a stately home and there was an artificial lake being built. And it's kind of about, again, colonialism, ghosts, class, money, who gets to tell the stories, who sort of who thrives. And all of them are sort of very different and brilliant. There was just so many great books. So there are three that I'd recommend.
You always feel like you're leaving people out.
I do. I know I've left out. I can think of people I've left out already. Always.
Chris, the Boyzone documentary, No Matter What, is another thing that passed me by, and yet I've heard people talk about it so much over the course of the year. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's terrific. I mean, if you told me a year ago, though, that one of my TV highlights of 2025 would be a documentary about Boyzone, I'd have probably laughed at you. But here we are, and this is what happens when music documentaries do what they're supposed to. I think the best are the ones that go out of their way to hold your interest in a band you might never have shown any interest in before. And that was the case with Boyzone, No Matter What. You have here all four surviving members of the group, Ronan Keating, who also produces, Keith Duffy, Shane Lynch, and Mikey Graham, speaking separately, being interviewed separately, and then three of them convene around the table at a bar for the very last episode about their, you know, often turbulent and unfortunately tragic history. There are outside voices. Louis Walsh is interviewed here. We also have Michelle Gately, sister of the late great Stephen Gately, who died at the age of 33 of pulmonary congestion resulting from an undiagnosed heart condition, and various kind of tour managers and music video directors. But this is Boyzone's tale, and this documentary gives them a chance to tell it, and they tell it brilliantly. It sort of covers all the things that you know in terms of, you know, how these lads auditioned when Louis Walsh wanted to put together an Irish Take That, how he booked them a late, late show slot despite the fact that they had rehearsed absolutely nothing, and how, you know, within a year they had a number two single in the UK, and they went on to have these record-breaking tours to sell 25 million record sales, performing to 100,000 fans in London, the breakup, so on and so forth. But it also educates us. It tells us things that we really didn't know, which is that at one point, you know, at least at the beginning, Mikey Graham was supposed to be the front man for this band. I didn't know this. A lot of fans might not know this. You know, he was a solid singer. He was the only real musician at the time. And he went away to work on his craft, instructed so by Louis Walsh. And when he came back, he'd realized that the first album had been recorded without them. And as a result of this, he stayed in the band because financially it made sense and because he loved the other guys. But he never spoke to Louis Walsh again for the next 7 years, which is unreal. The documentary also covers, unfortunately, the disgraceful case when the Sun newspaper called up Stephen Gately to say that we're going to out you as a gay man, and you've 24 hours to make your own response, and the pressure and the upset that caused with Stephen Gately and also with his family. Louis Walsh probably doesn't come out of this documentary very well, because especially when they're talking about that case, the other lads are visibly upset, whereas Louis Walsh is excited about the fact that they did get the front page that time, focusing on the wrong things. And it also deals as well with Stephen Gately's untimely tragic death in 2009, and how again the press were reporting, you know, incorrectly about that tragic event. I think think the one thing that really stuck with me about this documentary is that most bands will tell you, like Boyzone, that they're brothers and that, you know, they're more than just a band. But when Boyzone say it here, you do sort of believe it. You do get the feeling that these guys, despite the fact that they've had their ups and downs, they would do anything for each other. And they have, off the back of this, decided to do a couple of final gigs in England. I think they should have done them here, to be honest. But look, this surprised me. It's clever. It tells the story brilliantly, and it's profound and moving.
Okay, the clip we have from the documentary is this one here, and it is Ronan Keating, Stephen Gately's sister Michelle, and Louis Walsh reacting to that front page story in the Daily Sun, outing Stephen Gately, and there is language in this.
What's fucked, man? Boyzone star Stephen Gately has chosen the Sun to make his courageous announcement. Fuck you. You can fucking choose.
It was very, very difficult for him.
It's horrible for him. It's heartbreaking. That paper doesn't show any of the truth and what he felt or what was going on. Oh, fuck me. It was awful. It was a terrible time for him.
Oh, you got the full paper. Oh, my God. Boy, I'm Stephen, I'm gay and I'm in love. Oh, he's talking. It's a great picture. World exclusive. Wow. I love it. Page 22, 23. This is when the song was big. And it's the lead story. Wow. It's good to see it. And it got the front page.
And that's from Boyzone, No Matter What. It's on Sky Documentaries and now Zara Hederman. Music and non-English language albums are something you wanted to make sure you focused on.
Yeah, this is like a really interesting topic. I mean, stemming back even to like Kneecap last year as well, bringing the Irish language to the fore. This year was really dominated, I think, by Bad Bunny and Rosalía in particular. So Bad Bunny released his sixth album, Debbie Tarar Mas Fotos, which looks at, you know, different things of like gentrification, loss of identity. And in it's such an incredibly inviting and infectious album because he melds Puerto Rican music that he grew up with and everything from like salsa, bamba, cha-cha-cha. Like, it's really fun and infectious, but also in doing that, by bringing the identity side to it, is really important because I think it's something we're seeing with this non-English language style music is people reclaiming that and their heritage. And then Rosalía as well did it towards the end of the year with Lux, which is one of the most extraordinary releases of the year. She spent about 3 years working on this album, and part of that was because she was learning 14 languages to sing across it, including that is Ukrainian, Latin, Arabic, German, Japanese, French, Italian, Spanish and English. And she also has an amazing guests of Bjork, Charlotte Gainsbourg, Pharrell Williams and the London Symphony Orchestra. And it's just a really remarkable piece of work in that it completely envelops you. And then when you look at, you know, what she's singing about, so she basically took a kind of model of looking at the feminine mystique, transformation, spirituality, and pinning it with different kind of female saints and myths, and just a really interesting way of melding her own experiences both with her relationship with religion and romantic relationships, and also bringing that into a kind of contemporary context.
It is extraordinary that what you could probably call the phenomenon album of 2025 is Rosalía's album, and the fact that she's going to be coming here now and playing tours, that's not something I think any of us could have flagged at the beginning of the year.
No, absolutely not. I think people, like, she'd always been kind of regarded for her genre blending and she was hugely successful, but I think the level of artistic ambition on this and just the way she's opened up people's, like, her fan base's palette to a different style of music and a different way of thinking about how you can create music can't be understated.
This is the one that you may have heard, Rosalía, from the album Lux, and this is Burgain. Rosalía from the album Lux, and that is the one and only Burgain. We thought at the very end of our panel tonight that we might give each of you the opportunity to have a very quick chat about things that you're looking forward to in 2026. So Paul Whittington, films already, there's just a heaving amount of things we need to pay attention to next year.
Yeah, but the one that really interests me is there have been teaser trailers for this for about 6 months, Christopher Nolan's Odyssey. And I'm really interested to see what he's going to do with it. He's a go big or go home director, as we know, and people love like big effects laden films of his, like Batman films and so forth. But my favourite film of his is Dunkirk. I like him best when he is sort of lo-fi almost and filming in the moment. And this film looks like a film set in the Bronze Age should be, you know, gritty, grungy, unpleasant, as it must have been. And this film stars Matt Damon as Odysseus, who begins his eventful journey home from the Trojan Wars. And it just looks really interesting because the storytelling looks really good. There's mythologizing, but it just looks really sort of down and dirty. So I'm fascinated to see what he's going to do with this story.
Okay, Sinead, books of 2026, what's immediately taking your attention?
I'm going to go with three books. And I guess you and I have both seen Hamlet, which is incredible. Everyone's going to be talking about Maggie O'Farrell, but her new book, Land, is coming later in the year. It's based on actually her great-great-grandfather, who worked in Ireland for the Ordnance Survey. I've read a good chunk of it and it's incredible. Another brilliant writer who won the Booker a few years ago, Douglas Stewart, has a novel called John of John, which is set on a kind of Scottish island. He's a young gay man, his father's a Pentecostal minister, so there's all sorts of, sort of conflicts going on. And then closer to home, a lot of people love Patrick Crane's wonderful TV writing in the Irish Times. His debut novel, Experts in a Dying Field, is coming out. It is about a band. He was a musician himself and in bands for years. It's very funny, it's very moving, very experimental, and it's really good.
It's one of those books that is on my shelf at home and I have such high hopes for it. I know, and I will. I know I'm going to love it. Chris, TV for this year, is that slightly harder to do?
I think so, yeah. There's an awful lot coming at us, as there usually is, but the one I'm particularly looking forward to is Lisa McGee, the creator of Dairy Girls, her return to television with How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. It is, it's not her first comedy, but it's her first mystery, and it follows the story of three Irish childhood pals who come together to investigate the untimely death, the mysterious death of their old classmate, because they're, you know, they're a trio, but there actually used to be four of them. So you've got Roisin Gallagher, who's actually going to have a very busy year with the third and final season of Nancy Harris's The Dry, also coming at us this year. Roisin Gallagher and Sinead Keenan and Quailfin Dunn. Quailfin Dunn, wonderful actress, had a bit part in A Thousand Blows last year, but it's great to see her front and centre in a show like this. They are the three pals, but there's wonderful support, deep breath for the support. Emma Scanlon, Tom Basden, Ardal O'Hanlon, and Brona Gallagher are on the sideline. So great cast, wonderful creator behind the scenes. I think it's going to be an eight-hour-long episodes for Netflix, and it was all shot in and around Belfast last year, so very much looking forward to that.
The pressure for a series like that.
I know.
I can't. After the absolute global success of something like Dairy Girls.
Yeah, I think it's going to deliver, but I wouldn't want that pressure. You've had one of the most talked about sitcoms in the last 10 years. What are you going to do next? I think it's going to be a winner.
And finally, Zara, music of 2026, how's that shaping up already?
So January is looking good for us. So we have Dry Cleaning, a London band. They're coming out with their album Secret Love, which has been produced by my hero, Kate Le Bon. So singles from that have already been really great and have shown how their two sensibilities have melded really well together. So that is coming January 9th. And another one that has popped into my head is Mary Lattimore, who's an incredible harpist and does a lot of really interesting loop arrangements with her harp. She has paired up with Juliana Barwick and they're doing a collaborative album which I believe is coming out January 16th, so that will be fascinating. And basically anything Mary Lattimore does is just so magical, so that would be one to listen to.
It has been a fantastic and very full hour. If you missed any of this, you will be able to listen back to it either on the RTE Radio app, on our page on the RTE Radio 1 website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Paul Whittington, Sinead Gleeson, Chris Wasser and Zara Hederman, thank you so much for joining me tonight. That's our final Arena Before Christmas. Our broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton, sound supervision by James Feeney. Tonight's producer was Reg Luby. And before we sign off for the break, myself and the Arena team would like to wish everybody in the arts community, the creators, the performers, the people behind the scenes, the critics, and you, our wonderful listeners, an absolutely fantastic Christmas. I've been allowed to play something at the end of the show, which is one of my choices of 2025. So we're going to finish out with a song I love this year. This is the Mary Wallopers, and it's The Juice. Good luck.